are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, October 16th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Marshall Steinbaum from the Roosevelt Institute on the death of Sears at the hands of a vulture capitalist. Meanwhile, Lindsey Graham calls for regime change in Saudi Arabia, presumably so he can continue to sell them weapons. And the state of Georgia working hard overtime to disenfranchise black people. Living our La Vida Loca without the Voting Rights Act. Chuck Schumer got played again. Republicans plan judicial hearings in October.
Yeah, but, well, whatever. That's all I have.
And the Laffer curve fails again. We're not in Kansas anymore. In the wake of a corporate, GOP corporate tax cut. Meanwhile, the Trump administration looks to kill the Chicago police reform deal because why not?
So I say vote for the Green candidate.
DHS finds more attempts to hack U.S. elections and does nothing about it. Meanwhile, a New York Police Department seeks 9 Proud Boys on riot charges. And Yemen on the brink of the worst famine in 100 years. Maybe if people get exercised enough about a Washington Post columnist, we'll be able to avoid some of that. And Charlie Kirk's Turning Points USA Florida chapter slinging racist memes. And Tucker Carlson's Yelp account goes dormant. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Let's just jump in this very quickly. I know we weren't planning to do this, but I'm so distraught by what's going on with Tucker Carlson that I want to put this up on the top of the show. I wasn't planning it. I mean, we will talk about the Graham in a moment, but this is too tough, folks. Too tough. Tucker Carlson, who, you have to understand, people get into habits, into ruts. You live in New York City. Maybe you have a small kitchen. Maybe you get home from work too late. You can't cook for the kids. But Tucker has none of those issues. Tucker is not only well-paid because of his Fox gig, but even when he lost all those different jobs that he lost and was desperate to make a name for himself with the, was it the Daily Caller? I think it was his thing. Even then, it wasn't an issue because, of course, he's an heiress or an heir to the Swanson frozen food fortune. So Tucker is used to eating out and used to eating out at nice places. All right. So the transition is that much harder. That's why this makes the story that much more difficult. It would be easy to slough it off and just say, wow, you're like 99% of the people now. But that discounts how difficult it is for some people to change.
It's loss aversion.
Exactly.
It's a term in behavioral economics. It's not the same for him because he's used to a certain lifestyle. Empathetic, Sam.
I can't really go out to a lot of restaurants anymore because I get yelled at. Tucker said on a National Review podcast released on Monday. I don't feel threatened. But having someone scream, fuck you, at a restaurant, it just wrecks your meal. Carson said he only goes to one restaurant these days. I go there because I love it and nobody hassles me. Oh, incidentally, that's the Palm Steakhouse. I think you can probably find that.
That place is still open?
Yep.
Jesus.
I can't wait for this revolution to end so I can go back out to dinner. So, if you scream at someone to the point where they have to leave the restaurant, that's an act of wild aggression, he said last week on his television show, which promotes race wars and also promotes people like Gavin McGinnis and
promotes vigilance against gypsies.
Yeah. Vigilance against gypsies. Right. Spreads neo-Nazi propaganda about South Africa.
But the only restaurant that he can go to anymore is the Palm.
That's a real bummer, the steakhouse for lobbyists.
I was simply trying to...
Yeah, that is what we
like
were.
Being, really, like being gay in the 1950s.
It is just like being gay.
This is my impersonation of myself at a restaurant Tucker's at.
And, of course, the irony is the Palm, it's not on the Upper West Side, right?
No, this is in D.C.
It's in D.C.
Oh, is he in D.C.?
This is
a lobbyist. The Palm. It's like a lobbyist place.
19th Street, Northwest D.C.
He lives in D.C.
Oh, he lives in D.C.
And Jefferson Place. That's 19th Northwest Street.
Well, then he's got
Jefferson Place.
All right. Well, then forget everything I said about the feeling bad for him, because he's got a big kitchen, probably.
No, I thought when you said none of these problems apply to him, that was the joke about him not being in New York.
Oh, no.
I thought you were actually setting that up. I thought you were doing that on purpose.
No, I didn't know. But, I mean, I knew. I mean, there you have it. So, Tucker Carlson, just waiting for this moment to pass so he doesn't have to deal anymore.
Keep him in your prayers.
He should be forced to eat those frozen dinners.
That's right.
They won't swear.
Probably has a ton of...
It would be cool if the delivery man did. The Swanson delivery man was just like, oh, here's your frozen dinners from your fortune, and fuck you.
There you go. Folks, staying properly hydrated is one of the most important factors in flu and cold recovery prevention. Jamie, if you're listening, what did I tell you? Stay hydrated. And we actually just got a new box of them in, so I don't know why she must not have seen that. Thankfully, Liquid IV provides the same hydration as drinking 2 to 3 bottles of water. It is not your average electrolyte drink mix. Liquid IV has 110% the daily value of vitamin C, B12, and non-GMO clean ingredients. It's a healthy alternative to traditional sports drinks. And it delivers hydration to the bloodstream faster and more efficiently than water alone. 5 essential vitamins. It also has more vitamin C than an orange and as much potassium as a banana. I pop one of these, like, certainly when I've got a cold, but also what I'm starting to do now is I put a bunch of these in my bag when I travel, because you can't obviously travel with electrolyte mix. I pop a couple of these on the airplane, put them in, it's powdered, put them in the water as I'm flying on the airplane. Maybe I'm imagining it, but it helps with both jet lag, because every time I go on a plane, it seems like I'm going to LA
grab
or Vegas.
Some of those.
But it also helps when occasionally I may enjoy the alcohol a little too much.
We're here.
I'm bringing a bunch to L.A. this weekend for Politicon.
I'm bringing some to Idaho.
We'll talk about
we'll
these.
We'll figure that out.
I love Liquid IV, and I know you will too. Right now, my listeners get 20% off at liquid-iv.com when you use my code MAJORITY at checkout. That's 20% off anything you order at Liquid IV's website. Go to liquid-iv.com. Enter my promo code MAJORITY to get your savings and start getting better hydration. That's liquid-iv.com. Promo code MAJORITY. Don't wait. Get hydrated today. All right, let's Right now, I mean, it's sort of interesting, and I'm not quite sure if this is a Republican attempt to seem reasonable, to keep a guy like Chris Murphy from getting out ahead of this. Maybe it's there is. I'm not quite sure. I don't know if it's because we have an impending massive catastrophe in Yemen with a famine that has been unrivaled in this century, within a century, not even in this century, within 100 years. But, and maybe just killing and dismembering a Washington Post columnist is just a bridge too far. Incidentally, Donald Trump floated the idea of a rogue killing. He didn't want to get into the mind of MBS, but it might be a rogue killing, I think he said the other day. And then apparently the Saudis were leaking that they were contemplating, now pretending that it was a rogue killing. Despite the fact for the past 2 weeks they've been insisting that Khashoggi left the embassy, which is a weird thing to circle and square. It's also weird, too, like, oh, my God, we accidentally killed this guy while we were torturing him before we rendered him. So what do we do to make up for it? Oh, I know. Let's chop up his body into pieces. Apparently, that's the line from the White House and from the Saudis. No word on what Thomas Friedman has to say about this. But here is Lindsey Graham. Understand, put aside the issue of killing a journalist. Put aside the issue of our support for a brutal bombing campaign of Yemen, where, incidentally, as a result of Trump loosening the restrictions on targets as a some type of fig leaf to protect citizens, the number of citizens that we have killed has, I think, doubled. Put all that aside, this isn't a personal offense to Lindsey Graham.
Saudi Arabia, the Secretary of State is heading over there now to try to get some answers about what happened to the Saudi embassy inside Turkey. You know what happened. Who's to blame?
Well, I know this. Nothing happens in Saudi Arabia without MBS knowing it.
Who's MBS?
He's the 33-year-old crown prince who jumped over other people. He's the son of the existing king. And I think he's on a bad track. I can never do business with
Pause
Saudi Arabia.
I love the idea that he is he has an issue with him jumping over other people, as if this is like some type of democracy or something, right? Like, he didn't follow the proper line of ascension to the dictatorship.
It's also that was a positive for him when people were writing fluff pieces, that he wasn't fitting with traditional monarchy protocol because he was a bold reformer.
The only man for the job.
He's completely disruptive.
He's very disruptive to the Saudi monarchy. That's why he threw a bunch of his relatives in jail. And that was reported positively. Like, look, he's being serious about corruption versus, I wonder why like a young, aspiring, unhinged
creative
autocrat
destruction
might put uncles in a, you know, detain them.
Creative destruction.
Instance with Saudi Arabia again until we get this behind us.
Right. And what does that mean?
That means I'm not going back to Saudi Arabia as long as this guy's in charge.
So you're telling the crown prince has to leave?
It's up to them, but I'm not going back. I've been their biggest defender on the floor of the United States Senate. This guy is a wrecking ball. He had this guy murdered in a consulate in Turkey, and to expect me to ignore it, I feel used and abused. I was on the floor.
Pause it. So if I understand Lindsey Graham correctly, all the other things that MBS was considering when he was going to kill this guy, putting aside everything that's happening in Yemen, according to Lindsey Graham, that MBS didn't stop and say, what will Lindsey think about this?
That's what Khashoggi should have said to the guys who were torturing and murdering him. That this will be very disrespectful to Lindsey Graham. Please stop.
I feel used and abused. I was on the floor every time defending Saudi Arabia because there's a good ally. There's a difference between a country and an individual. The right. MBS figure is, to me, toxic. He can never be a world leader on the world stage.
So what does the president do? Sanctions?
It's up to the president. But what I would do, I know what I'm going to do. We're going to sanction the hell out of Saudi Arabia. You know, We deal with bad people all the time, but this is in our face. I feel personally offended. They have nothing but contempt for us. Why would you put a guy like me and the president in this box right. after all the president has done? This guy's got to go. Saudi Arabia, if you're listening, there are a lot of good people you can choose, but MBS has tainted your country and tainted himself.
Like who? Who to replace him?
That's up to them. It's not my job. But
this is so bizarre because Lindsey Graham is literally going on trying to pitch to the president what he should say. That's what's going on here. I mean, we have a, I don't want to say a five-year-old. I think it's closer to a four-year-old in the White House. And Lindsey Graham is sitting there trying to just model behavior for Donald Trump. But look, the bottom line is Lindsey Graham has laid down the gauntlet, ladies and gentlemen. He is not going back to Saudi Arabia because that guy has embarrassed him. And we know when Lindsey Graham says something, his word is his bond. This guy is not the type of guy. This is not a fair weather senator. Let's play this clip. I'm confused. Wait, oh, this is from, just about a year or two ago. Okay.
I just don't believe Donald Trump is a reliable conservative Republican. Good luck with Paul Ryan trying to find a conservative agenda with this guy. And I don't think he has the temperament or judgment to be commander in chief. A lot of my colleagues will vote for him enthusiastically. Some will hold their nose. I just can't go there with Donald.
But Senator.
Oh. Oh, and now he's his biggest fan. So
now he's his biggest, literally one of his prime advocates in all of Congress.
So would you say Lindsey Graham is going to be in Saudi Arabia by early December? Or do you think this will be he'll wait until mid-December?
Yeah, he seemed really peppy there. So, but on the other hand, you know what? It's going to depend on how savage the winter is in D.C.
That's
Saudi
right.
has nice weather in December.
I will reserve judgment to find out if it gets rainy and cold.
Just keep me in the loop. Just keep me in the loop on the weather forecast.
All 3 months from now.
No one can do what MBS is doing.
We got to take a quick break. Golfer. When we come back, Marshall Steinbaum of the Roosevelt Institute on the death of Sears. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program, Research Director and Fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, Marshall Steinbaum. Marshall, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start in on this. This story of Sears, they've basically announced that they're heading into bankruptcy. This has been a slow, in some respects, pretty quick, I guess, when you look at the how old this company has been. But this is a story that we have seen quite a bit. We saw it with Toys R Us. We saw it with Anchor Hockey. We saw it with Sports Authority. We've seen it with many other companies. Tell us what happened to Sears.
Well, I think you can definitely draw a line with those other examples. I think what you see is that companies with established market shares in brick and mortar retail face in the sort of broad sense, rising competition from online and other distributional methods, and basically financial interests like hedge funds and private equity kind of see this, and what they see is that this is an industry that is going to be in long-term decline. It's going to lose market share, but that presents an opportunity where if they can take control of the business, then they can, you know, radically cut expenses, lay people off, load the companies up with debt to pay themselves a gigantic dividend. And, you know, yes, that will push the company out of business. They might, by doing that, cause it to go out of business a little bit more quickly than it would have had the sort of, you know, natural evolution of the market played out. But that presents an enormous profit-making opportunity in the meantime. That is, the customers are going to leave, but they're not going to leave so quickly that you can't make an absolute killing during the period of time that you just control and parasitize this declining business. So I think that's what we saw with Sears and with those other companies.
I mean, is it the case, though, I mean, that there was that the demise of all of these companies, is that inevitable? And my understanding is that, from, you know, like, for instance, with Toys R Us, I haven't seen the sales figures for Sears. Part of that just seems to be complete mismanagement because this thing fell off a cliff. But Toys R Us.
I mean, I think the story is probably, you know, variations on a theme across all of these companies. I don't think it's, you know, totally inevitable that Sears has to be replaced by online. I mean, Sears itself could have changed its business. And, you know, you take a company like Amazon that has profited so enormously at the decline of brick and mortar retail. I mean, that's a company that doesn't take profits because, you know, while they have enormous market share, they use the proceeds of that, or sorry, enormous market power, they use the proceeds of that to expand into other lines of business. And, you know, they're really interested in growth. That is, not taking money out of the business for the shareholders today, but ensuring that the business as a whole is as maximally powerful for the long run as possible. And, so, you know, it's hard for an outsider to say that that business model was available to Sears too, but in any event, it just didn't follow it. Instead, these older companies kind of succumb to what I would consider the sort of shareholder first ideology that says, well, you know, we're in a position where we don't have to do that much work to make a ton of money right now. Let's do that.
You know, 2 points. One is Sears, if there was any business understood, you know, a delivery by mail in this country for the past 100 years, right? I mean, yes. It was Sears. I mean, they literally right. Yes. Pioneered this idea of, I'm not going to a store. I'm looking at pictures of it. It just right. happened to be in a magazine right. as opposed to, I mean, in a catalog as opposed to online. But just, I want to tease this out in plain language so that people understand really what the dynamic is here. Because on some level, it starts with essentially, it's basically looking at an animal that is slightly wounded. And instead of going in there with the intention of, oh, I'm going to capture that slightly wounded animal, it's going to be easier for me to capture them, and then I'm going to nurse them back to health. It is, I'm going to see that slightly wounded animal, and I'm going to eat it. Because it's. I mean, that's yeah. basically what's happening here. So walk us through this, how this went with Eddie Lampert. Because when we say shareholder, it feels like, oh, mom and pop down the street with their pension. There may be some of those people, but yeah. this is, we're talking about one guy who had, and one fund, maybe he had some money from his friends as well, but are going in to take a massive company with tens of thousands of employees and essentially sucking its blood to make himself, just himself, like bigger.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I think we really need to adjust our thinking when it comes to, you know, what is a shareholder and what is the concentration of power by shareholders mean in this economy. It is definitely not mom and pop and their pension fund. What it is, you know, the wealthiest interest in the economy basically consolidate not just, you know, the kind of legal ownership of companies, but they use that legal power that being a shareholder gives them to take control of boards of directors, install their own faithful puppets. And in many cases, you know, I think it's even a kind of anachronistic to talk about shareholders and managers and executives being independent interests in this economy. That's kind of the old way of doing things. Now, the the concentration of power within corporations is such that managers and shareholders are essentially the same people. I mean, CEOs are invariably nowadays among the largest shareholders of the companies that they control. And that's, you know, by design. We have policies and we have an ideology that encourages managers to be personally invested in the companies whose decisions they're making. And the idea was, well, that would mean that they would make better decisions because they would personally benefit from them. What it has actually meant is exactly what you pointed out, is in the case of Sears, where, you know, the company becomes a sort of parasitized a profit-making entity where the whole goal is to benefit the people at the top at the expense of all of the other stakeholders, be they consumers or workers or suppliers to the company. I mean, all of these other stakeholders are there to be kind of sucked dry while the company is still in existence and to gusher the money out to the kind of shareholders slash executives at the maximum possible rate.
So now, was Lampert CEO, was that his official title? I mean, go ahead.
I'm actually not sure about the answer to that. I think he has been at times and not, but I'm not entirely certain.
Okay, but he does own about almost 48% of the stock, and so he control.
And, you know, and I mean, his business model was exactly as you described it, as he saw the wounded animal and, you know, used his financial power to operate it completely in his interest.
I mean, I want to go through some of the sort of the highlights of this so that people understand. And so people, the way for people to conceive of this is that Lampert came in and he appears to be the CEO of Sears. And he by appears, I mean, well, he is the CEO of Sears, but we all are stuck in this mindset that if you're the CEO of a company, your goal is to make that company succeed. But what we don't realize is that he's also the CEO of, you know, Lampert Enterprises. I'm making that up, but that's basically the way he sees this.
Yeah.
And Sears is just one element. And so one of the things he does is he sells, Sears owns all their stores. He sells all of Sears stores to another entity that he sets up called Seritage, and then leases back the properties to Sears, except for the good ones he sells off to other interests. And basically, I mean, this is a scam. It really, I mean, this is a total scam.
Yeah. No, you have this sort of like separate entity, you chop it up and then you milk Sears by having it pay rent to this other thing. And the other thing, you know, doesn't have pension obligations, doesn't have creditors, you know, for the reason, you know, so such that, you know, when Sears declares bankruptcy, it's like, well, what does Lampert care about that? You know, he got all the money out through this other entity, or, you know, as you said, sold the most valuable real estate to, you know, what I would assume would be like more real estate companies.
Right. And people should understand, if Sears goes into bankruptcy and owns all of this property, that's a major asset for them to sell off to pay their creditors, to pay Lampert loaned money to Sears, put himself in the first position as a creditor, and down on the list are those people who get pensions from Sears, people who deferred their compensation so that when they go into retirement, they would have the ability to get the money then. But those people are going to take the haircut because there's no assets anymore because he stripped them off. He stripped off Land's End, which is another division. He just kept basically... It's like he took this tree and he cut off all the limbs, all the leaves, anything of value that would still be there, and loaded up debt onto the trunk of this tree, essentially.
Yeah, and I think your, you know, allusion to the idea that, you know, workers might have been invested in the long-term health of the company through deferred compensation and pensions kind of gets to the difference in the way that American capitalism is practiced now versus in the past. I mean, in the past, you know, you're a worker who, you know, has some degree of dependence, but also investment in your employer, and you would see that as like a stable thing that you would, you know, wouldn't mind having your own, you know, family well-being tied up in it in more ways than one, because, you know, you'll draw your pension after you retire. Well, you know, that is a kind of relationship that what I would call in economic terms an implicit contract, where some, you know, financial raider like a Lamper would come along and say, oh, that's a profit-making opportunity for me. You know, these workers are working there thinking they're going to get some benefit out of it in the future. You know, I can legally rob them of that benefit by loading up the company with debt, subordinating the obligations to them. And, you know, I'll kind of re-engineer the terms of that contract so that I'm the one who benefits from it, and the workers who think that they're that they have a stake in the long-term health of Sears, you know, are going to be left holding the bag when, as you say, you know, all the leaves are stripped off and the branches are cut down.
And we should say that none of these things were done out of desperation. I mean, it seems like he had a 10-year plan. Right. Like in 2014, he sells off Land's End, which is one of the more profitable aspects of their business. He owns 60% of that company. And so he's got that money and that is secured. Creditors don't have a say on that. That's not part of the bankruptcy filing. He sold off the properties, like we said, to Seritage. So all of those assets are also, you know, secure, put away. He sold off Canada, Sears Canada, and owns a big chunk of that as well. I mean, it's almost as if, like, you're involved in this marriage. You see, you know that you're going to get divorced in 5 years, and you start taking money and burying it in the backyard, essentially. And by the time that you guys split up, we got no savings. I don't know where that money went.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. I think that's a very good analogy.
So what can we as a society do about this? I mean,
what
has changed? Let me put it this way, because I know that, you know, we've heard this story in terms of Toys R Us. I think Mitt Romney was involved in that one. Bain was a big sort of pioneer in this business. Where they go in and they basically take this, they buy this entity and they take all the value out. They load it up with debt. They crash the company. They make money off the fees and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, they literally pick apart this thing and they leave the carcass. The carcass is really just the tens of thousands of workers and maybe the community that relied on it in many respects. What changed? Was there anything from a statutory standpoint that changed that opened the door to this? Or was it just simply that our culture is just
degrading? Yeah, there's plenty. I mean, there's many different sets of policies that changed that basically legalized that kind of business model that would once have been illegal. I work a lot on antitrust policy, which pertains, you know, it's definitively about what kinds of profitable business models are you allowed to engage in and what types are you not allowed to engage in. And, you know, there's just very plain evidence in the economy that business models that used to be illegal are now widely adopted and extremely profitable. I'm thinking of things like franchising, vertical integration, which we know is a huge issue in telecoms, where our telecom sector is way less competitive than other countries that have more effective antitrust. Our tech sector is entirely the child of a loose antitrust enforcement of the modern era. That's one area of policy. When you say are there statutory changes, like we still have the same antitrust laws as we had from 1890 and 1914, but what changed was judicial interpretations that really baked in a kind of a retrograde and simplistic economic theory into the law and said, you know, the law used to mean this one thing. Now it means this other thing. This other thing means that nothing that businesses want to do can ever be anti-competitive, can ever violate the antitrust laws. We should assume that whatever they're doing is actually efficient, that it will serve consumers. And consequently, the liability got reeled way back in. Beyond that, I think, you know, in this case, there's a lot of changes in terms of how corporate governance functions. So like for one thing, stock buybacks, whereby companies take their profits and use them to buy back stock owned by shareholders, the main way that shareholders take value out of corporations, those used to be illegal. I mean, they were just flatly illegal under SEC regulations up until 1982, when under the influence of this kind of idea that you want the executives of the corporation and the shareholders of the corporation to have one another's in, or to, for the executives to have only the shareholders' interests at heart when making decisions, you know, a key way that executives were supposed to be able to make shareholders benefit from the profits earned by the company was through stock buybacks. And so instead of being illegal and assumed to be insider trading, stock buybacks went to basically de facto legal. There's also huge changes in tax policy basically, you know, as I would say, it used to be illegal to be rich in this country in the sense that the top marginal income tax rate was 90%. So if you're, you know, in that top tax bracket, why would you want to earn another dollar? Why would, you know, if Eddie Lampert, who's already rich, already owns a hedge fund, says, oh, well, here's this wounded animal there. I can, you know, totally take control of it and strip that carcass. Well, if 90% of the meat that you strip off it is going to go to the government, why would you care that much about, you know, doing that? And now, you know, so that's certainly statutory changes that have radically reduced effective marginal tax rates on the rich, such that, you know, now the government, I mean, as we've seen with the Trump empire, you know, he's barely paying anything in taxes. You know, so you see that carcass, you know, full of fresh meat, and it's like, great, let's eat, you know, because we're going to get to keep all of it, and the government's not taking any anymore. That, you know, so that's kind of like what policies reined in the power of executives and shareholders to profit by dominating these companies that they own or run. And then you have, you know, a whole set of other policies that were about empowering countervailing stakeholders, like unionization, like labor standards, where the point was to say, okay, well, workers have to have a seat at the table whenever major consequential economic policy decisions are being made, whenever the pie is being sort of split up and doled out within companies. You know, you can't just kind of steamroll the workers and take everything for the shareholders. So I think, I mean, there's a whole panoply of things that just make the economy function much, much differently now, as you've been describing, relative to how it used to be.
And we should say a lot of the things you're talking about, I mean, they have been ongoing, but the buybacks change by the SEC was in the 80s. The change in the perspective on existing antitrust was following Robert Bork at the Chicago School, where we changed from a posture where we saw antitrust to be an issue not just in immediate savings to the consumer, but broad-based implications of having that type of consolidation of power. That was flipped on its head. We've never returned back to that pre-Borkian perspective on antitrust. And, of course, the change of the tax laws, really the biggest change that happened with the capital gains taxes under Reagan was the big one. We haven't seen any Democratic or any Republican, for that matter, also reversals on that. And like you say, all the forces that would mitigate these changes. It's basically we just unleashed the greed, right? I mean, that was basically what, you know, the 80s were all about. I mean, I think, you know, greed is good. And we still dress it up slightly differently now, but we still operate in that fashion. Speaking of antitrust, I want to just also touch on Amazon for a moment. You brought them up in the context of being, you know, at least wounding some of these animals and allowing for them to be just wounded enough to, you know, have a vulture swoop in and finish them off. Amazon announced a couple of weeks ago, presumably because they were ashamed by Bernie Sanders and his sort of introduction of a piece of legislation to get Amazon to raise their minimum wage. It turns out that the majority of Amazon workers are still not going to get a $15 minimum wage. Why is that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think when the announcement was first made, there was a big question about how widely this would apply to Amazon's contractors as opposed to the employees who work directly for the company. And it sounds like, you know, not a lot, which is a major concern. I mean, one of the major kind of labor market trends is the outsourcing of workers to staffing firms, to, you know, kind of upstream suppliers in the supply chain where the dominant firm can disclaim responsibility for adhering by labor law and cannot, you know, they can like if Amazon were to be unionized, you know, it would be a totally different thing to unionize its contractors. And these are ways in which, you know, powerful companies increasingly kind of put their workers at a distance and an arm's length where it's much easier to exploit them. And, you know, Amazon has certainly been in the forefront of doing that with its logistics supply chain. And the question was, well, basically, would those contractors be included in this new company specific minimum wage? And, you know, increasingly, the answer appears to be no, or at least there are a lot of exceptions. The other thing I would say about that is that that's also an antitrust story. I mean, it is definitely a labor story, in the sense that our labor laws are tailored to employers having to provide certain benefits to workers in exchange for working for them. And if you can kind of legally at least extinguish the employment relationship, even if you are in reality the person who controls the worker's day-to-day life, as Amazon is for all of these contractors, then you can kind of wriggle out of all your obligations. The antitrust part of that is, well, even so, if you put these workers kind of in a different firm so that they're not under the same roof, legally speaking, you can still force them to do what you want. So this is a key area in which antitrust has become much, much weaker since the 80s, that you firms that are up or downstream in the supply chain from a dominant firm, that dominant firm can still force contractual terms on their suppliers. And then those in turn, the suppliers in turn, you know, turn around and extract wage reductions from their workforce. So the crucial issue is, you know, who has control and who has responsibility. And what you get in a company like Amazon is that the dominant firm has total control thanks to the retreat of antitrust laws, while totally avoiding any responsibility in the form of the retreat of labor laws.
Where would, like, the National Labor Relations Board, in the event that we had one that was not essentially, I mean, that it was, you know, sidelined, but an aggressive National Labor Relations Board. I mean, like, I'm just thinking of the McDonald's case where they had determined that even though these are franchises,
Joint employment.
That it's really joint employment.
Yeah.
I mean, how much of that would would be also another angle in which you could attack this?
Well, you could, in theory. I mean, under Obama, there was better, you know, kind of guidance from the National Labor Relations Board, that is to say, more expansive definitions of joint employment, and thereby, you know, not just your immediate employer, but also the firm that they're functionally affiliated with, that is to say, you know, McDonald's Central and the McDonald's franchise, you know, could jointly be held liable for violating the National Labor Relations Act, or the, I think it was the Fair Labor Standards Act, but, you know, National Labor Relations Act in that case. So that's certainly a thing. I would say that even notwithstanding the provision for joint employment, the National Labor Relations Act is really premised on organizing workplaces as single employers or single firms. So it's very hard to organize an entire sector of workers. And in fact, you know, workers are forbidden from striking against any firm that is not their direct employer, which means, you know, that they're functionally, you know, trying to get something out of Amazon. Well, they can't take, you know, kind of industrial action against Amazon because Amazon's not their employer. So I think it will take a kind of revolution in labor law that abandons that kind of firm-based conception of where does responsibility for workers lie, either at the sectoral level. I think that's one interesting proposal that's been made, or, you know, frankly, from the government. I mean, one, you know, we keep talking about, well, what does it mean that the sort of traditional employer has declined over the years, that, you know, people don't, you know, if they ever did, who knows, but, you know, people don't still work for the same employer for a whole career. You know, that militates in favor of greater provision of social insurance and labor standards directly from the government, because the government's not going anywhere.
All right. So lastly, let me, you know, how much of a revolution do we need for all of this? In other words, I mean, if we were to get in, I mean, obviously Elizabeth Warren, antitrust has been a big issue for her. I imagine, you know, someone like Bernie Sanders also has a fairly developed sense of what needs to happen on an antitrust level. But let's just, you know, a generic lefty politician who has an awareness of these issues. If they were to become president, like, what more do we need? Do we need, like, a generation of new judges? Are there statutory fixes that could return us to an antitrust regime that is more robust? I mean, how many years would it take in the best case scenario to fix something like this?
Yeah, I mean, frankly, you know, it's a daunting task. You know, I think lots of statutory changes are needed. Recently released a paper with my co-author, Maurice Stuckey, called The Effective Competition Standard. So that's a series of mostly statutory reforms to antitrust to basically correct the mistaken jurisprudence. I mean, antitrust is a nice one in the sense that we don't have the same sort of constitutional nonsense coming from the courts as you know, so that what the, when the courts have weakened antitrust law, what they're doing is saying, you know, the Sherman Act, you know, used to mean X, but we actually think it means Y. They're not saying that the Sherman Act is unconstitutional. Now, having said that, if we did pass, you know, legislation to amend the Sherman Act to take away some of this terrible jurisprudence, then, you know, these conservative courts might say, oh, well, actually, you know, the entire Sherman Act violates the First Amendment. So, you know, nice try. They're certainly good at modulating their arguments. I mean, taxes is another area where it's just a matter of, you know, I mean, I would say, you know, 95% a matter of bad laws being passed, and we need to pass better ones. I think, you know, on the larger point, and you know, and then I don't want to mitigate the extent to which the judiciary is a gigantic problem. I mean, you know, we've seen this before where even when you do get a generational progressive shift in legislation, you know, the fact that you've got an unelected chamber of rich old white men deciding what our economic policy is, you know, becomes a major barrier to action. And this is why in the, you know, second half of the New Deal, the Roosevelt administration, you know, was forced to resort to at least the threat of court packing. Of course, the threat in that case was enough to get what they wanted,
right.
So they didn't actually have to follow through with it. But, you know, all of those sorts of major institutional shifts, you know, definitely need to be on the table. On the sort of larger point I want to kind of get to, because as you said, you know, well, you know, Senator Warren or Senator Sanders might have a sense of kind of what's necessary in terms of reforms to the economy. I mean, you know, I think those politicians have been, vocal leaders in the sense of like what's wrong with the economy, pointing out the concentration of power. But I also want to, you know, point to individuals and people to take action on their, you know, on their own. And in some sense, you know, that's necessary. It's a necessary precondition. I worry a lot about this idea of, you know, on the one hand, people saying, you know, well, this, you know, the economy clearly has lots of problems. It's, you know, hard for a kind of lay person, you know, normal people understand at a deep sense that they're being screwed over economically, but precisely how and precisely which piece of legislation was tweaked one way and now needs to be tweaked back in the other direction, you know, that can be daunting. But, you know, nonetheless, it's necessary. I mean, this is, you know, even the powerful can withstand the most intense public outcry unless it is directed at, you know, specific changes that will actually be powerful. And I worry that a lot of, you know, the kind of dissatisfaction that people that we hear about the economy is inchoate in some sense and will be ultimately, you know, horribly not that threatening to the incumbent powers unless it can be channeled towards specific ends that actually are responsive to the issues of the concentration of power. I mean, put it this way, you can't get around this issue. What we've been talking about, how, you know, powerful hedge fund managers or private equity people control the economy, you know, as important and necessary as free college or Medicare for all might be, and how it might, you know, radically lessen the profits available to health insurance executives, you know, restructuring the power relations in the economy cannot be done just through that means. That requires the types of policies that ultimately the New Deal came down to. And I think ultimately a lot of people who deal with these issues on a day-to-day basis, like I am, and coming to, you know, major reforms to progressive taxation, to antitrust, to labor law, that kind of thing, that really are functional about functionally shifting who has power in the economy.
Marshall Steinbaum from the Roosevelt Institute, thanks so much for your time today. That's that's part of what we try and do here, is to get incredibly weedy and specific.
Yeah.
And thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. There you go, folks. Not going to get any more narrow than that. We get down to basically like specific bills. But those are the three, you know, antitrust covers a lot of this. But the antitrust and the sort of the way that we incentivize the whole concept of shareholder value as a way of running companies. And then, of course, you know, encouraging enormous greed, even if it comes at the expense of other human beings. That's basically, that's the game plan. Here's, what is this?
You see this Lewis Hyman?
Lewis Hyman, he was just on the show a few weeks ago.
Gotcha. I thought it looked familiar.
It's fantastic. This is, it's fascinating. It hadn't occurred to me, but, we did have Lewis on the show, right?
Yeah.
Oh, very recently. What was the book that he wrote?
Temp.
Oh, The Temp, right. In my history of consumption class, I teach about Sears, but what most people don't know is how radical the catalog was in the era of Jim Crow. This makes total sense. Every time a black Southerner went to a local store, they were confronted with forced deference to white customers who would be served first, and the store would be filled with racist caricatures of black people in an effort to sell to white people. The stores were not self-service, so the black customers would have to wait, and then they'd have to ask the proprietor to give them goods, often on credit because of sharecropping. Landlord often owned the store in every way, a shopping reinforced hierarchy, until Sears. The catalog undid the power of the storekeeper, and by extension, the landlord. Black families could buy without asking permission, without waiting, without being watched, without national, with national, i.e. cheap prices. Southern storekeepers fought back. They organized catalog bonfires in the street. Wow, these general stores often doubled as post offices, and the owners would refuse to sell stamps to black people or money orders to use the catalog services. Interesting.
Trissy McMillan Cotton said it reminded her of sort of how Uber and these sorts of things also laid a sort of initial frictionless or less friction for, you know, minorities or people that are oppressed.
Interesting. You could just bypass the actual post offices by giving the letter and money to the mail carrier. Interesting. Interesting history in terms of Sears, and but the broader story is, you know, where we have a an economy structured in such a way that we think the guy is the CEO of Sears, and really what he is he's just the guy coming in to extract all the value. He's just a vampire.
I'd also just like to point out that that's a useful case study for when you get into arguments about with libertarians about how it was the poor shopkeepers they wanted to serve black people,
right.
But it was the strong arm of the Dixiecrat governments that were saying, nope, you can't do it, even though it'd be better for your bottom line.
Right,
sir.
Of course. Of course. It's completely ahistorical.
It's just irrational for me to not be able to serve African Americans with dignity and respect. It hurts my bottom line. God damn it, you will
you
read
know,
Marx and you will discriminate.
I just got a letter from Sears asking me to re-up on my four-year protection for my dishwasher.
No.
Well, I mean, they're going into bankruptcy. I don't know what's going to come out the other end.
Dude, that's probably a final cash grab.
So Mark Green tried to do that with Air America at one point.
Really?
Yes. He calls me up. This is right after, I'll tell the story. This is a fun half story.
Let me tell you something in preparation for this fun half story, because I'm sure plenty of people probably don't even know who Mark Green is.
Well, Mark.
And I said, one time I asked you, though, before you, I get into all of it later, because it's going to be good. But when I really wanted to understand in the beginning of when you first started talking about this guy, I was like, Sam really doesn't seem to like this guy. And because I just knew him as just basically like a kind of annoying liberal pundit. I didn't really know much about him one way or another.
He was almost mayor in New York City.
I realized that because I looked him up after you talked about him a bit. And I said, it's your choice, Mike Bloomberg or Mark Green's mayor of New York. And you actually were like, I don't know.
Right.
And I was like, whoa.
Yep.
And Mark Green is a bad...
Oh,
bad guy.
Speaking of the fun half and Mike Bloomberg, you will not guess who is, I don't know who you say promoting, but seeing the value of perhaps a Bloomberg presidency. You will not guess.
Do you want to try to guess?
MBS?
Nope.
Thomas Friedman?
He is actually friends with Mark Green.
MBS is friends with
Mark Green. No. This guy I'm talking about.
Speaking of Green, though.
Okay, so it's going to have to be some type of garbage sort of...
No.
A good guy. Oh, Ralph Nader.
There you go.
Nailed it. Chalk it.
All right, we got to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the show. Ladies and gentlemen, just a reminder, this program relies on its members for 96.3% of its revenue. At, of course, that number is
as an aggregate over the course of 18 months. That's the way we do our accounting here. I have no idea what we're saying. I just I also wanted to get Marshall on the phone to see if how we would how I would load up the majority report with all sorts of debt and start selling off like the sets or something like that, rent out the chairs. But in the meantime, before I figure that out, your support as a member is what keeps this show alive. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content every day. Just a reminder, I'll be debating Charlie Kirk this weekend. It appears that it's going through.
The Clash of the Titans.
Oh, yes. And I'm going to be doing a couple of panels that... a little weird.
Way to sell it.
Well, I mean, I sent them an email saying, hey, you're aware there's no socialists on this Should We Be Socialist panel. And then you know what their response was?
What?
Nothing.
Wait, is that like the panel with you and Pacman and Kalinske?
I think Marcus Melitzis and there's one other person. Like, there's no.
So there's like a couple of social but Democrats.
But I think I
and
saw that Elizabeth Brunig was Liz Brunig was going to be at
She's
Politicon, and so I sent an email
That's
and said, like, what about Liz Brunig? She probably said, I don't want to be on a panel like that. But
I mean, whatever. On the other hand, it's like, hey, it's somewhat vernacular, and who cares?
I mean, it's not.
I mean, some people are obviously talking
it's
social
not the
democracy.
Biggest, it's not the biggest deal in the world. It's just going to be an awkward panel.
And it will be awkward. They should get Jason Unruh.
all right, folks. Today, oh Jesus, it's only Tuesday. Hey, it is only Tuesday, folks, and that means that we're nearly at Tuesday night. And on Tuesday nights, the Michael Brooks Show happens.
Can you guys check that IM that I just sent you, though? It's apropos of nothing, but it's hysterical. That's hysterical.
Just, well, what's happening tonight on the show?
What's happening tonight on the show is Anoa Changa is joining us. We're talking about her grassroots work in Georgia. Let's just look at this.
Well, we'll
first.
Do the,
okay.
the fun half. We'll
oh, sorry. Okay. We're talking about her grassroots work in Georgia, the Stacey Abrams race and voter suppression and how the sort of dynamics of Southern Democratic politics are turning to the left, but also, you know, grafting onto the strategic white supremacy of the Republican Party. The commentary will visit on Nancy McLean's Democracy in Chains, which I think is one of the most important books for everybody to read right now. And hopefully we'll have her on the show soon as well. And, of course, all of the regular segments. 7 o'clock live tonight. Majority Report YouTube channel, but also check out our YouTube channel at Michael Brooks Show and get the whole thing at patreon.com/TMBS.
All right, we're going to take a literary hangover. What do you got this week?
Literary hangover, I did the Hope Leslie thing. I'm going to be doing a monologue form. It's going to be just me solo this Saturday. I'm going to be talking about the Mystic Massacre, the Pequot War, and that sort of stuff.
Your co-host couldn't handle the heat.
Co-host is a moving, so shout out Alex, but he'll be back shortly after then. But
shout out to moving.
Yeah, shout out.
All right, folks, gonna take a quick break. Headed to the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be right back after this.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance.
Ooh.
scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.